Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. In this episode, we're exploring some of Appalachia's most unique destinations on the water and beneath it. You know, I normally think of scuba diving as something you do in tropical places. I've never really thought about scuba diving in a mountain lake.
And nobody can reach you underwater. Your cell phone doesn't work.
No. It's nice and quiet and peaceful.
And we'll join a group of children as they learn paddleboarding on a river.
My name is Evan and I am 12 years old.
Have you ever done this before?
No.
How are you feeling about it?
Kind of nervous because I'm afraid I might fall off.
And yes, as you travel along our riverbanks, you'll see trash. But that doesn't mean it'll be like that forever. On this show, you'll meet one man who's made it his mission to clean things up.
And I like these places. West Virginia is a beautiful place, and it just doesn't deserve to be trashed this way.
That's all coming up this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. It's December, and it's cold. So this week, we're taking a bit of a time hop trip back to the summer when we produced an episode all about getting outside and exploring Appalachia's rivers and lakes. We'll explore the ways people enjoy the water through boating, along with taking a trip under the surface of a mountain lake. But it is West Virginia, and we can't have a show about Appalachian waterways without talking about whitewater rafting. After all, just about any search on Google for the best whitewater rafting or most dangerous whitewater rafting includes West Virginia. Around 150,000 people commercially raft a West Virginia river each year, most on the New River and Gauley River, which go through Fayetteville. There were around 30 rafting companies in the area at one point. Today, they've conglomerated into six major adventure businesses. And for visitors, the face of those companies is often a raft guide or a person who's professionally trained to know the local river, but also to know people. Not just anyone can do it, trust me. I tried in college and it was fun, but not easy. The concept of a river guide in West Virginia started to form in the late 60s, and today there's an entire culture within the guiding community, one that's been passed down for decades and is developing more each year. Our folklife reporter, Caitlin Tan, spent a day with the guides on the New River in southern West Virginia. Here's that story.
I'm on a raft with seven other guests on the lower New River. The water is warm, the canyon surrounding us is tall, and it's covered in thick green trees. Birds are chirping, there's a slight rainy drizzle. The arch of the New River Gorge Bridge glimmers in the distance. We're with a guide who goes by the name Ray Ray.
This is the best life in the world. I actually have two college degrees. I've never used a day in my life.
Roger Wilson is the CEO of Adventures on the Gorge, a river guiding outfit in Fayetteville. He says all the guides have a deep love for the outdoors.
There's something that happens when that first wave hits you. Whitewater rafting is either in your blood or it's not. And when that first wave hit me, I was addicted.
Roger says guiding is not for everyone. There's a large social aspect. One has to be able to read people just as well as one reads the water. Dave Bassage, who's been guiding since 1984, says there's a close mutual respect between him and the customer.
I really love the dynamic of having a crew of different people every day and introducing them to what I think of as the dance with moving water. And we're just one of its partners, and we've got all these other partners in the raft.
Being a river guide can be a nomadic lifestyle. The season only goes from March until October. Jay Young, the media manager for Adventures on the Gorge, says many of the river guides work at ski resorts in the winter, or they continue guiding in South America.
Everything they own fits in the back of their truck or their car, and they're off to the next destination for whatever's in season, whatever adventure sport is in season.
The guide leading the boat I'm on has made a career out of the industry. Ray Ray has guided in West Virginia since 1992 and worked on dozens of other rivers across the world. On our trip, there's four other rafts with guides in our group, but Ray Ray is the trip leader. He consistently checks in with the other guides.
Y'all ready? You ready, caveman? Let's do it. Let's light this candle.
All the river guides have nicknames. One man with shoulder-length blonde hair goes by Caveman. He got the name because of where he lived for about 8 months, the span of a full rafting season.
I was looking around through the woods one day, found this cool little rock house, like overhang, and just made it into a house. I actually had an endangered species of salamander that lived in there with me. It was pretty neat.
And Ray Ray's nickname is a bit of a mystery, but Jay has a theory.
Ray Ray is Ray Ray because he's twice the fun.
Ray Ray gives us paddling commands.
Like forward and back. Forward and back. All right. You're not using your arms. Let's try it again. Everybody rock forward.
There are long stretches of calm, scenic floating. Ray Ray explains the history of the area, and he tells us stories, like how different rapids and obstacles in the river got their names. There's Greyhound, Flea Flicker, Meat Grinder, Old Nasty, and Miller's Folly.
Kayaker named Miller got stuffed up underneath that rock years ago. He was trying to get to the right-hand side of that rock and run a real gnarly line over there, but got flushed in under it. He swam out alive, which is a million-to-one shot. He needed to go buy himself a lottery ticket.
Ray Ray's skin seems to be permanently tan. The fine lines on his face are of a person who's worked outside all their life. When he sits on the back of the raft, paddle in hand, he's in his element. Mostly, he jokes in a playful voice with the guests.
And remember I told you, I don't bring you back, they're going to dock my pay. So you better make you swim, okay?
But in serious moments, Ray Ray exudes confidence. His voice booms, his commands are clear. In the rapid sections of the river, the raft pushes itself through the raging white water. Everyone gets soaked. Ray Ray guides us the entire time. My recorder is kept safe in a dry box, so the sound is a little muffled. After this rapid, we pause to check on the other rafts in our group. We're approaching an obstacle called Meat Grinder.
Just a collection of undercut rocks where the water just goes under and through it. We say water goes through, bodies do not.
Some people are thrown out of their raft in the rapid above Meat Grinder. They're not part of Ray Ray's group, but he immediately springs into action. The possibility of something catastrophic happening is low, but Meat Grinder is one of the more dangerous areas on the river. The guides react quickly.
Guys, back it up! Leave the boat and swim! Swim!
Everybody was fine, but it's because Ray Ray and the other guides on our trip are experts on reading the water and reading each other. Something Jay Young, the media manager for Adventures on the Gorge, says is just part of being a professional guide.
If you were to hang out at the guide camp or even in the bar on a Saturday night, you wouldn't think that these guys are, you know, the professionals that they are. But when the poo hits the fan on the river, there's nobody else that I would want out there with me. Nobody else, because they rush into action. They all know exactly what to do, and it gets done fast.
Guides have always had their own language, whether it's hand signals on the river or talking about water depth or names of rapids. And Ray Ray says it's evolved over time.
Like we're going to be running one down here called Flea Flicker that a lot of old-timers used to call it last kick in the pants. For the most part, though, over time has evolved, and, you know, it's just a way for us to communicate. It's like our own kind of language, you know? It's like speaking river guide, you know, speaking hippie.
And it's the senior guides, like Ray Ray, that teach this new language to the up-and-coming guides, people who might not have prior rafting experience, but are brought together through their love of the outdoors. Like former Inside Appalachia intern Claire Himmy. She's a first-year guide who is new to the river, but she took the job because she wanted to be paid to work outside.
It's just this wonderful, eclectic mix of everyone from everywhere who just want to be outside.
River guides have always been adventure-seeking people. Roger Wilson, the Adventures on the Gorge CEO, says he started guiding in 1975, and he says the concept of the commercial rafting industry was still new.
Every rock wasn't named, every route wasn't ran. There was still that point of discovery. We were developing an industry, developing something new that no one had ever done before.
Today, safety is a top priority. Before getting on the river, everyone signs a waiver. Ray Ray asks each person about their health.
Any kind of pre-existing medical condition will not keep you from going on this trip either, but I need to hear about those back condition, heart condition.
But that wasn't always the case. Charlie Walbridge guided on the Cheat River in northern West Virginia from the late 70s until the early 80s. He says there wasn't a guide in every raft, people didn't sign a waiver, and guests were often treated like friends rather than a paying customer.
If somebody fell out of the boat, you know, we'd certainly go help them. but we laugh at them. And, you know, there were all kinds of slang. You know, when I first started, the guests were turkeys, and then they were carp, and then they were geeks.
And today, guides are almost always in every raft. And there's more respect between the guide and customer. Roger says guiding has become a way to share the love of the sport.
It evolves to watching these new guests hit these rapids for the first time and watching the smile on their face.
Back on the New River in the raft with Ray Ray, we are finishing up our day. For most of the guests in the boat, it's the first time down those rapids. But for Ray Ray, he's done it thousands of times. And he'll be out again the next day, likely guiding more guests down the same rapids. But he still has a big grin and excitement for the river.
Thank y'all very much, man. Y'all played hard today. I told y'all that was going to be a fun ride today, man. That's a rowdy ride.
Back on shore, all the rafts are deflated and loaded on a trailer. All 32 people in the group load up on a bus where cold beer and soft drinks are waiting. Ray Ray has one last message.
Guys, keep getting off your couch and go living your life. Don't watch this go by. Part getting the game, guys. Here's to y'all. Thank you. Yeah, rafting! Yeah.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan in Fayetteville, West Virginia.
Now it's time for our occasional series, What's in a Name, where we explore the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. So as we just heard, the New River is one of our region's most popular rivers for whitewater rafting. According to local lore, the New River is actually one of the oldest rivers in the world. We checked that with a geological expert, and we're surprised by what we learned. More on that right after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
That's the sound of Inside Appalachia folklife reporter Caitlin Tan paddling along the New River. Before the break, I told you that a commonly held belief is that the New River is one of the oldest in the world. Some people claim the river is more than a billion years old. But it turns out, that's not true. According to Steve Kite, geologist with West Virginia University, there are rocks in the New River drainage that are a billion years old, but that doesn't mean that the river is a billion years old. Geologists just don't know exactly how old the river is. Kite says it could be as old as 320 million years old, or it could be 3 million years old. Another mystery is who named the New River. Jay Young is a raft guide, and he wrote a book about the history of rafting on the New River. But when it comes to who named the river and why they called it the New?
For every story out there, there seems to be another clue that refutes it. So it's all a little bit muddled and kind of nebulous.
Here's what we do know. In the 1600s, an English fur trader and explorer named Abraham Wood claimed to have discovered the river, and he called it the Wood, after himself. But then the river mysteriously began appearing on maps, no longer as the Wood River, but as the New. Nobody has a shred of evidence documenting who changed it or why, says Dan Thorpe, an associate professor of history at Virginia Tech.
At some point between its discovery in the 1670s and the 1750s, it was apparently named the New River, but we don't know by whom or for what reason.
Thorpe says that on some maps, the New River is labeled as the Kanawha River. That's the river it becomes after it joins with the Gauley. Maybe some cartographer realized the mistake and thought the river needed its own name. Maybe the older name of Wood River was lost to history, or maybe someone just didn't like the guy. In any case, someone just decided to call it the New, and that name stuck. By the way, the New River could have turned into a very different type of waterway. Dan says that in the late 1700s, not long after the New became the New, developers began to build a giant canal system along the James River in Virginia. The idea was to use the wild and turbulent New River to transport huge freight boats from Virginia to the Kanawha River, which eventually runs into the Ohio and onto the Mississippi River. But that plan never took off. For one thing, well, can you imagine how expensive it would be to carve out a canal through the wilderness of the New River Gorge? Also, says Thorpe, the timing clashed with another industrial development.
It was never finished because railroads beat it.
Can you picture giant shipping boats going through the New River Gorge? Though it would have dramatically changed the economic landscape of southern West Virginia, it's hard to believe they would have constructed a canal that could take ships across all those heavy rapids. And it would also likely mean there'd be no pristine mountain views, kayakers, or whitewater rafters today. If you know another story about the New River, or you have a place in Appalachia you'd like us to explore for What's in a Name, send us a tweet at InAppalachia or send us an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org, and we just might explore it inside Appalachia. In that What's in a Name segment, I mentioned that the New River and the Gauley form the Kanawha River. The Gauley flows into and out of Summersville Lake in Nicholas County, West Virginia. The lake was built in 1966 as a flood control project and now is a popular spot for water recreation. Paddlers, rock climbers, as well as people driving motorboats use this lake. But have you ever thought about scuba diving in a lake? Our associate producer, Eric Douglas, is a diver himself. He recently traveled to Summersville, and he brought his recorder with him in a dive beneath the surface of one of Appalachia's clearest mountain lakes.
Walking to the edge of Summersville Lake on a Saturday morning, the lake is pristine and calm. Most of the boaters haven't made it out on the water yet, so the lake is quiet. However, this story isn't about what's on the surface of the water, but what's beneath. My visit to the lake begins with an unexpected reunion with an old diving buddy. Ed Skaggs.
I used to spend so much time here at Summersville, whether it was just pleasure diving or as an instructor teaching students.
Ed used to be my diving instructor. When I head to the lake to make a dive and interview other divers for this story, I'm surprised to see him pull up in the parking lot. I haven't seen him in nearly 20 years, and he hasn't been diving in the lake in nearly 10 years himself.
Just life has gotten in the way, and it feels good to be back up here again.
I made my first dives in Summersville Lake in the summer of 1990. And completed more than 60 dives there before making it to the ocean. My diver certification led to diving opportunities around the world. After catching up a bit, Ed invites me to make a dive with him. After gearing up, we wade into the water. Descending, the water closes over your head and you feel weightless, or at least as close to it as we can get on Earth. It's easy to imagine yourself flying like a superhero. As we swim, we encounter fish, rock structure from the original hillsides of the valley before the lake, submerged trees and stumps. Everything looks brown or light green. For the first 25 feet or so, the water is warm and clear. Looking to my left, the water gets deeper and darker. I've been down here before, and there is nothing scary about it, but it does look ominous. After about 45 minutes exploring the area, we make our way back to the surface. It may come as a surprise that a lake known for fishing, camping, and boating is also a favorite destination for divers. They come to the lake to take classes, practice their diving skills, and just have fun in the water. Bob Sharp, a dive instructor from Charleston, has been diving the lake for more than 30 years.
So tell me what diving in Summersville is like for you.
Well, for me, growing up watching diving on some of the TV shows and things as a young person, it was just opened up a whole new world underwater, you know, all the rock formations and the fish. And when you got your landlocked sort of, you know, we don't have an ocean around us. This is West Virginia's ocean right here at Summersville Lake.
A group of divers from north central West Virginia is also visiting the lake. Scott Peterson is wearing his wetsuit and putting his gear together for the upcoming dive as we talk.
What brings you down here to Summersville to dive?
As far as I know, it's the best freshwater diving in the area for visibility and water, and a nice spot to do it here where you can get close to the water.
You're obviously a certified diver, so you're not training today, but you still come back to dive here.
Yeah, we come back in the summer try to do three trips in the winter, whatever, to nice places in the Caribbean, but this is just fun diving, and you're always training and practicing.
Scuba diving isn't something you learn once and then forget about. To stay safe, you need to practice those skills regularly, says John Clemens.
Tell me what brings you down here to Summersville Lake.
Going to Summersville is a good place to practice your skills in a safe environment to prepare you. So when you go out on a nice trip somewhere to Cozumel or Jamaica or something like that, that you're proficient and you're safe and you get to focus on having a good time.
Shake off the rust a little bit.
To keep the rust off, you have to dive. I think it's every 6 months or so. You have to keep fairly current to keep your skill set so that you'll be comfortable whenever you get out in salt water.
The reason Cecilia Peterson likes to come to the lake is a little more basic. She just enjoys it.
What do you like best about diving down here?
Oh, I just think it's, I don't know, the water's clear. You can see, I mean, just, it's peaceful, it's pretty, and just a nice day to, you know, spend the day out here, but it's nice just to come out here.
And nobody can reach you underwater. Your cell phone doesn't work.
No, it's nice and quiet and peaceful.
Likely the most common question divers hear as they exit the water is, what do you see down there? Or what is it like? Like everything else, the answer is different depending on who you ask. For Ed Skaggs, it is a particular place and the feeling he gets from it.
What's your favorite spot up here?
Well, it would be Long Point.
Long Point is an elbow in the lake that is only accessible by boat. Since there aren't any shallow areas nearby, the water remains clear. It is one of my favorites as well.
There's so much cover for fish, so you see a lot of fish, a lot of structure. There is places where you can swim underneath of fallen rocks. It's almost like flying.
Bob Sharp's favorite spot is easier to get to. It's a place near the dam where Christmas trees are sunk for fish habitat.
We also have a place where I call it the Christmas tree forest. You got a lot of juvenile fish over here, and so you can go over there and see quail fish.
A big part of diving is what you do between dives. It's called a surface interval in diving terms. You talk about diving and what you saw, but there's also a shared community among divers. Bob Sharp enjoys that aspect of diving as well.
Like I did when I got here, and say, where are y'all from? And how's the water? And, you know, so you can talk about that. And then if you have a problem, you work with each other. And that's what I really appreciate about people from West Virginia in general, is they're welcoming and they're willing to help each other out if there's a problem, or just, you know, socialize a little bit.
Years ago, a diving magazine referred to Summersville Lake as the Bahamas of the Appalachians. Most divers simply chuckle about that and wish they were in the Bahamas. But it does make for a nice dive when you want to get underwater or hang out between dives for your surface interval. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Eric Douglas in Summersville, West Virginia.
You can watch video of parts of Eric's dive on our website at wvpublic.org. There is a myth that the town of Gad is still underneath Summersville Lake. Eric asked a representative from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers about it. They maintain the lake and the dam. Their representative explained that there might be a road or house foundation left in the deepest parts of the lake, but they say the town of Gad was torn down during the construction and preparation for the lake. For a lot of us growing up in Appalachia, rivers, lakes, and creeks are the first place we swam, played in the water, or caught crawdads. These waterways are important to our way of life. For our next story, we're heading up to explore some of the waterways in Pennsylvania. Every year, kayakers and canoers come to western Pennsylvania, to the areas just east of Pittsburgh, to ride the rivers in a four-day, 44-mile journey. Yep, that's right, I said 44 miles. It's known as the Stony Kiski Conemaugh River Sojourn. The group paddles through deep river gorges, a few Class II or gentler rapids, and historic towns like Salzburg and Blairsville. They camp each night along the way. About 30 paddlers make the whole trip, and another 50 or so join up for one or more days. The Allegheny Front's Andy Cubis joined the Sojourners on their last day amid the sounds of cicadas and breakfast, and recorded this report.
Wait a minute, I'm sausage or banal? I'm up to finishing my delicious breakfast that they brought. My name is Rosemarie Stover. I am on the Stony Conemaugh Kiski Sojourn.
20th annual.
20th annual, yes. I come on this. I've probably been on it 6 years now, and I come. I love the people. The river, I grew up in New Kensington, and so this is kind of brings me back home again. It's going to be a gorgeous day.
Where's our bus?
We're catching the shuttle bus to go back to
Avonmore so that we can start the paddling part of the trip.
Anybody has not signed the boat manifest, you need to come over and see.
Oh, I should.
Today we are traveling from Avonmore to Roaring Run, 7 miles. There are some shallow ripples, occasional standing waves, easily avoidable.
My name is Brooke Handley, and I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, and this is my first sojourn ever. It's even more than what I expected. I told everybody I kind of feel like I've been at summer camp for the past 4 days, which is awesome.
You ready?
Yep.
Okay, here you go.
Go. Ooh, that's cold. First day I dumped out, which is okay, but every other day, knock on wood, I haven't dumped out, so I'm learning as I'm going how to navigate things, and I've gotten a lot of great advice from all of the veteran paddlers, so learning a lot.
I'm Amanda Wareham. I am from the Pittsburgh area. I have the orange, green, yellow kayak, and they said, I'll just call it a Skittle, and when I bought it, I said, oh, it kind of looks like a lifesaver, so it, for me, it was high visibility, but the other option was pink, and I didn't want a pink one. Most of us lead our lives and never really think about the rivers, but the river's such a big part of the ecosystem, and part of what we've done each evening is to have some educational sessions, and they've talked about in the last 30 years really how the river life has been revitalized because, you know, primarily mining is what has really knocked out, and you can still see signs of it. There are some areas where you can come down and you can see the runoff where you can tell that it's iron ore and things like that. So it's a neat area where we got the chance to learn about it as well.
Looks like rapids.
So my name's Laura Hawkins. I am what's called a Greenway Coordinator for something called the Pittsburgh to Harrisburg Mainline Canal Greenway. This Kiskaconomaw River system is sort of infamous. This is the path of the Johnstown flood. The Kiske River is the largest tributary into the Allegheny River. So what happens up here affects everything downstream and all of the Pittsburgh rivers.
My name is Mark Shank. I'm from Blairsville. So I'm a local from around here. And first time I ever come down the river, the Conemaugh River, through the Pack Saddle Gap, I was 16 years old. And the water was pure orange.
Excuse us.
So if you had anything white on, your parents knew where you were. And it's so nice now that the river's cleaned up. We got fish in it, it's good fishing, and wonderful recreation.
A little bit of water in there, kind of evident.
You're taking some of the water home as a souvenir?
Yes, sir.
Now's the not so fun part, and you have to haul them up a hill, load them on your car, take them home, give them a bath, make sure they're ready for the next run, because you should always wash your canoes and kayaks in between rivers so you're not transferring any bacteria from one river to another one. So you always go home and give them a good bath before you go on to the next place.
This is the hard part.
Yes, the getting out is the hard part.
That report was produced by Andy Cubis with the Allegheny Front. You also heard from Richard Bloom and Mike Burke. The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on the environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. We'll stay in Pennsylvania waters to learn about another program. This one combines paddleboarding and river surfing with digital recording. The idea is to educate the younger generation about how to protect local rivers. The group is called First Waves, and their motto is, "We inspire conservation in unconventional ways." The nonprofit group targets underserved youth across western Pennsylvania. The Allegheny Front's Andy Cubis also went to Johnstown to join a First Waves program. While the day didn't go exactly as planned, it was still a learning opportunity.
When Ian Smith started his paddleboard company, Surfs Up Adventures, in 2011, he didn't intend to take kids out on the water. He was picturing 20-somethings out for a good time. But then the state hired him to come up with a paddleboard program for at-risk teens.
I was really terrified because my first time, you know, working with teenagers.
Fast forward 7 years, and Smith's nonprofit, First Waves, has served hundreds of kids. Today, he's at a park along the Stony Creek River in Johnstown, getting things ready for a group of kids from a foster home nearby. The paddleboards are unloaded, wetsuits and water shoes sit in rows on picnic tables, and volunteers listen as Smith goes over the plan for the day.
So we'll start them in this eddy right here where the flow is obstructed by that wave, and we'll work on getting the kids comfortable standing up in that area. Sound good? All right, and they're arriving, so I'm going to go handle that. What's up, guys?
Oh, yeah. The kids file in, and some are pretty nervous.
My name is Evan, and I am 12 years old.
Have you ever done this before?
No.
How are you feeling about it?
Kind of nervous, because I'm afraid I might fall off.
Others, like 17-year-old Cameron, have done this before and are excited to be back.
I'm hoping to have a lot of fun. Get back on a paddleboard. It's been about a year and a half.
Just welcome to Greenhouse Park. We did have a crazy rainstorm, so don't worry about these crazy-looking water up here. We're going to go down below where it's a little bit more calm. So we got some awesome DSLR cameras. We got microphones. So we're going to be teaching you guys to tell the story of the day.
The story of the day was supposed to go like this. The kids split up into two groups, half get into wetsuits and practice balancing before heading into the river. The other half gets a lesson on documentary filmmaking and record their friends' river adventures with GoPro cameras and boom mics. Then they switch. But on this day, the river has a different plan.
I don't think I'm going in there. It's not worth the risk, right? I don't know what it is.
We don't know what it is.
Right in front of our eyes, the river has turned an alarming shade of black. Kirsten Wingler is a volunteer. She's supposed to teach paddling skills today.
I've been on this river for 28 years. I've never seen it that color.
Never seen it. I've done a lot of river running in some dirty water. I've never seen this color, so I'm confused. I don't know what this means.
One of the adults standing nearby thinks he has a pretty good idea what it means. Chad Gonkovich runs the Whitewater Tubing Company in town.
So this is with the heavy rain that we had. We're assuming that one of our bony piles or coal fields had a landslide into one of the local creeks. All that coal dust just makes the water, you know, look black. And if you look closely to it, you'll see big hunks of coal coming in.
Just upstream, there's a coal mine and a rail yard with piles of coal along the tracks. What exactly happened is still being investigated by the state. But Ian Smith quickly shifts gears.
If I can leave you with anything today, it's to remember this experience and hopefully inspire you to want to make a change in this. So do a great job documenting this, and today you're actually going to use it with purpose.
The kids begin taking pictures and using the video cameras to document what's happened to the river. But 14-year-old Nakia can't hide her disappointment.
It was sad. It helped me understand the rivers a little bit more. All this bad stuff goes into it, then this affects the animals' ecosystem and the trees and stuff they eat.
17-year-old Raquel is just as bummed.
We're kind of hoping that it does clear out. We didn't really get to go surfing today because the water is this color, so.
Can come back next week?
Hopefully, yeah. Good. I'm hoping.
Me too. Yeah.
The next week, the kids do come back, and this time, the river cooperates.
This was awesome!
It's 15-year-old Haley's first time on a paddleboard.
I did a wave my first time, too. It's awesome. Wreck and roll.
That's crazy. These kids are nuts.
And Evan, the kid who was nervous about falling off.
That was amazing. I'm definitely going to do it again.
Now he's a pro.
I fell off of the board, but I swam my way back to shore.
And the conservation part of it, they're getting the hang of that, too.
We see any trash on the river today?
Piece of metal. It's from a pipe. Guess I should get them out of the water.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Cubis.
Nice eddy catch, man! All right, Donna, now your turn. You can walk your way out.
The kids in that program learned an important lesson. When the river was fouled, they weren't able to enjoy their day. And perhaps the work of the person we'll meet in this next segment will help to bring back more family-friendly activities on the rivers in Morgantown, West Virginia. It ain't hard to find abandoned campsites along the rivers, and in them are people's abandoned belongings and trash. And rainy weather can easily wash these things into the waterways, contaminating the river ecosystems. But one man has taken it upon himself to load up on his bicycle and use a grappling hook and a strong magnet to clean up the trash. Caitlin Tan has the story.
I'm standing with Zoma Archambault on the banks of the Monongahela River. We're at one of his trash cleanup sites. To get here, we biked about 10 minutes from Morgantown on a paved trail. But the last stretch, we pointed our bikes down a narrow, hidden path into the dense green bushes.
All right, here we are.
It's a hot, muggy day. The spot we're at has a small sandy beach, which is rare. Much of the Monongahela River is lined by thick brush and mud. The area used to be an informal camp spot. Zoma found it abandoned, with trash covering the ground in every direction. It's almost all picked up now. There's some muddy clothes, a couple hypodermic needles, and roof shingles. The nearby stream flowing into the river erodes the dirt, exposing some of this older trash.
Yeah, there's still trash. It'll be eroding out for years.
Before showing me around, Zoma grabs a bag of raw oats from his backpack and feeds the minnows.
Do you always try to feed them a little when you're here?
Yeah, I can't help it.
Zoma loves living things. At one point in our interview, a stray cat emerges from the bushes and walks over to him.
Hey, buddy. You look really lonely.
Zoma has volunteered the past year and a half to cleaning up the trash sites along the rivers. Although he wants places to look clean, he says he cares more about the impact of trash on the ecosystem.
I strongly don't believe in, you know, of course, microplastics in the ocean, you know. We have a tremendous problem right now in the world because of it.
Microplastics are the size of a sesame seed and nearly impossible to clean, according to the National Ocean Service. And they are toxic to aquatic life and birds. Microplastics can form from littered plastic products, like a grocery bag, that over time break down into smaller and smaller pieces, eventually getting washed into our waterways.
Yeah, that stuff does not belong in our rivers.
Zoma is unassuming. He's lanky and tall, almost 6.5 feet tall. He has a gray goatee and a head full of salt and pepper hair. He typically wears a pair of jeans cut off at the knees with a loose cotton t-shirt. Zoma's always observing. While he's cleaning up abandoned camps, he often thinks about who the people were, why they had the things they did.
Memories and such. There's something, some reason those people carried that object with them.
But it's also personal for him. In the past 10 years, Zoma says he's lost 25 friends to drugs and suicide. And so cleaning these sites, where people were likely suffering from addiction, is a healing process.
So to help, I think, erase that, so it's just not out here, just to try to clear it up. And I like these places. West Virginia is a beautiful place, and it just doesn't deserve to be trashed this way.
Zoma grew up on the West Coast, but he settled in Morgantown 21 years ago. He says he's seen the city grow, and in the past couple of years, he's noticed more trash and a different kind of trash.
These sites used to be full of beer bottles. And now the transition now is to needles.
And this is a trend other organizations have noticed too. Jonathan Sweet is the operations manager for Friends of Decker's Creek. The almost 25-mile-long tributary of the Monongahela River flows through Morgantown.
We come in with tongs and a Sharps container and get rid of them. And they are definitely common, and it's really unfortunate.
Friends of Decker's Creek dedicates a lot of time to cleaning up trash along the waterway. Just a couple weeks ago, Jonathan cleaned up a site with a mattress pad, clothing, and blankets. He says the trash is a river ecosystem hazard.
It's bad for all the aquatic life that lives in the creek. And when you have a clean area, I feel like people are less likely to litter and dump their trash there as opposed to if it's already a really nasty, trash-filled area.
And that's Zoma's thinking, too. The first site he cleaned was in Morgantown at Whitmore Park last year. There were over 300 hypodermic needles, 3 tents, several futons, and other trash completely covering the grass.
I remember returning, like, 2 weeks later, just hoping somebody else had cleaned this up, and nobody had.
So he attached a small trailer to his bike, which he calls Big Red, and loaded up shovels, rakes, garbage bags, a machete for the thick brush, and he got to work.
We had to just to load stuff up on tarps to drag it out, like all the bedding, and just we couldn't put that in bags, of course, and we just made big, giant mounds of clothes, just amazing.
A lot of the sites Zoma cleans alone, but friends occasionally come and help haul the trash bags away. Zoma uses 33 and 55-gallon-sized trash bags, and just this year, he's filled 100. He likes to document the sites, taking before and after photos and videos, and then posting them to Facebook. Zoma and I bike to his most recent cleanup site.
This is where we're going right here.
It's still in the Monongahela River, and it's roughly the size of half a football field, with overgrown trees creating almost a roof.
Well, this place is not perfect yet. But I tell you, one thing is missing, and that's 25 bags of trash.
There's still some work to do, but Zoma's gathered all the remaining trash into piles. There's a Disney princess backpack, a Barbie with blonde hair, a chocolate milk bottle, Hanes underwear, and a moldy, medium-sized brown teddy bear.
I'll remove it sooner than later, or later than sooner, I'm not too sure.
There were 40 teddy bears that Zoma already threw out. Originally, he'd only found two hypodermic needles at this site, but as we're talking, Zoma uses a stick to rustle around in the dead leaves.
Number three. Number four. Well, so much for that.
Ultimately, he finds 18 needles within one square foot.
10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18.
Zoma uses the chocolate milk bottle to carry the needles out.
I don't think it's big enough.
So primarily, Zoma picks up trash on the banks of the rivers. But he does do some trash cleanup in the water. He's focused mostly on Decker's Creek.
Oh, it amazes me just how shredded, like, the plastic bags will be. It's already working its way to being microplastic, and it's not even hit the major rivers yet.
He's found bicycles, grocery carts, parts of bridges, furniture, old railroad ties, and a lot of old coal slag. Zoma uses a four-prong hook to pull out larger trash. It's about the size of a tennis ball.
It's a grappling hook. But I use to pull shopping carts out of the river or creek or whatever.
But for smaller magnetic trash, he uses a powerful magnet that's about the size of a grapefruit. We are walking along the banks of Decker's Creek. A big thunderhead is rolling in. Zoma has his magnet. It's attached to a long rope, which allows him to throw it in the river and reel it back in. Kind of like fishing.
This is 65 feet of rope. I can throw the whole thing.
The water is dark, and Zoma has cleaned up this location before. He doesn't expect to catch anything.
Oh, there's something on there.
Yeah, it sure is, isn't it? It's a steel ring of some sort.
Zoma puts the little bit of slag and metal we find in a yellow bucket. He'll throw it out later. There are hundreds of miles of waterways just in Monongalia County. Trash could potentially be everywhere. Even the spots Zoma has cleaned eventually get re-trashed. He says it's almost expected. But standing on the banks of the Monongahela River at one of his cleanup sites, Zoma smiles. He looks at the beach that was once covered in trash, and he's proud of the work he's done. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan in Morgantown, West Virginia.
We've spent a lot of time talking about rivers in this episode, from whitewater rafting to cleaning up trash, but have you ever stopped to consider how those rivers played into the history of settlement in Appalachia? The sight and sound of a sternwheel paddleboat might bring a bygone era to mind, but for some people, it's still part of life today. There is a community on the rivers of central Appalachia that's working to preserve that boat history. Eric Douglas takes us on a trip down the Kanawha and Ohio Rivers to find out more.
There was a time that life along the river revolved around riverboats. In the 19th century, the only way to get supplies or mail was the river. To keep the history of the river alive, a community of enthusiasts maintains riverboats for their personal use. Jack Fowler is the director of the Point Pleasant River Museum and Learning Center at the confluence of the Kanawha and Ohio Rivers.
These guys that have these sternwheelers now, they just preserve those memories and what it used to be like.
The original riverboats were called sternwheelers. The stern is the back of the boat, so these riverboats had a paddle wheel that provided thrust to propel the boat up and down the river.
It just keeps that spirit of the river alive, that it's still there and reminiscing about what it was like back in the day.
At their peak, Fowler said there were 80 to 90 sternwheelers working in the area. Today, only a few operate as work boats, but there are many more that private owners maintain for recreational use. J.D. Pauley is the owner of the Hobby 3. His boat was built as a pleasure boat. He spoke from the pilot house heading up the Kanawha River.
I've owned this boat for 22 years now, and it just the people you meet, the things you do, the places you go. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I wouldn't trade it for $1 million vessel.
Where do you see yourself going with this boat?
There's places I want to go that I haven't been to Pittsburgh, haven't been up the Allegheny, haven't been down the Mon, just down towards Paducah. I know it won't handle the Mississippi, but we can at least go to there.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, that's on my bucket list.
Just, it's like a big RV on the river. You can.
That's it. Yep. The river's the road, and it's a different view of the world out here.
Tom Cook owns another sternwheeler named the Juanita. It did start out its life as a workboat and is built almost entirely of steel, except for the glass in the pilot house, according to Cook.
It's a different way of life, and they're not cheap to operate, and they're not cheap to maintain.
But it's still important to you to do it anyway.
Oh, yeah. That's kind of like my hobby, so to speak. It's a different kind of boating. You have to have a little bit different mindset to be able to enjoy being on a stern wheel boat. You have to slow down. You can't get anywhere fast. If you want to go to Point Pleasant, Point Pleasant's 50-some miles from here, and it takes 7 or 8 hours. If you want to go by boat to Marietta, which is 140 miles away, it takes at least 2 days.
Being steeped in history, it's easy to picture the heyday of riverboats. That's J.D. Pauley's favorite part.
Well, you know the Jimmy Buffett song. Yeah, I was born 200 years too late. I would enjoy doing this years ago. And if I would have got into it sooner, I would have probably made a living on the river.
Yes, I am a pirate, 200 years too late. The cannons don't thunder, there's nothing to plunder. I'm an overboard victim of fate, arriving too late. Arriving too late.
There's a group called the American Sternwheel Association that works to preserve and educate the public about sternwheel boats. It started in 1976. Tom Cook, the group's treasurer, says the group's membership is falling.
It doesn't seem like that the younger people are as interested, or maybe they just don't have the resources to purchase. A lot of the people that own sternwheel boats now are getting older, so there's several for sale right now.
A series of riverboat festivals on the Ohio River in the fall bring the boats to where the public can see them and enjoy the floating history. J.D. Pauley plans his entire September around the events.
We leave usually the Thursday before Labor Day, go to Point Pleasant. They have a benefit for the Riverboat Museum. We usually pull out of there on Sunday morning early and head towards Marietta, Ohio for the Ohio River Sternwheeler Festival. We leave there and we go to Parkersburg, West Virginia for their River Fest. And then the next weekend is Pomeroy.
The song Proud Mary by Creedence Clearwater Revival tells a story about hitching a ride on a riverboat queen. It also says people on the river are happy to give. These riverboat people want to share their love of history to make sure people don't forget where we've been and how we used to get there. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Eric Douglas on the Kanawha River.
I've seen sternwheelers on the river in West Virginia, but it never crossed my mind what it took to keep those old boats working or why the owners did it. During summer times as a kid, I spent as much time as I could in the water. I can remember jumping from the diving boards at the Mullins Pool and barreling down the winding water slide at Lake Stevens. You know, in the song Country Roads, there's a line John Denver sings, "Miner's lady, stranger to blue waters." We might not have ocean access or beachfront property in West Virginia, but we do have a lot of water, and people are out there enjoying it. I'm fortunate to get the chance to travel to the ocean during most summers. But there's nothing quite like the lakes and rivers close to home, especially when you get to hear the stories around them. Summersville Lake meant the end of a town called Gad, just as the Bluestone Dam meant the end of the village of Lily, where my ancestors lived. A few years ago, I went to the former site of the Village of Lily for the first time. Not long after, I took my first trip paddling in a canoe on the Bluestone Lake. As I drifted under the Lily Bridge that's named after my ancestors who were pushed off their land when the dam was built, I wondered what life would be like if they were still on the river. It was also pretty cool to have something so massive and beautiful as the bridge hold the same name. If you want to see some of that history of the Bluestone Lake, by the way, we've posted a link on our website to an episode we aired in 2017 where I revisited the remnants of the Village of Lily. That's at wvpublic.org. There are stories like these all along the riverbanks. There's an abandoned building along the New River, and a raft guide told me that in that building was where the longest game of poker was played. Look it up. And I'll bet those raft guides have even more stories to share about those majestic and mysterious waters.
Left a good job down in the city, working for the man every night and day. And I never lost 1 minute of sleep, and I was worrying about the way that things might have been. You know that big wheel keep on turning. Primary keep on burning. And we're rolling,
rolling,
rolling, yeah,
rolling,
rolling on a river.
On the river.
Cleaned a lot of plates in Memphis.
You know I
pumped a lot of change.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Allegheny Front. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Spencer Elliott, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Tina Turner, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org to sign up for our new Inside Appalachia newsletter. On our website, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.